Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Porter Medical Center in Middlebury has been struggling to get its expenses to match its revenue for several years now. That's not unusual for Vermont's small community hospitals. Federal reimbursement rates and the need to switch over to electronic medical records have provided challenges, though another federal program that allows hospitals to buy pharmaceuticals at significantly reduced prices has helped keep them steady. Recently, Porter announced layoffs, which included 8 nurses, and it has pulled the contracts of all the Porter physicians and is requiring them to sign new, changed ones within 90 days. This has left a sour taste in the mouth of many people who work at Porter, and it makes some patients question if their care will suffer. But the leadership of the medical center says these changes are essential if the hospital wants to survive. So we are going to look at the situation today, and I'm joined now by Ron Hallman, Porter Medical Center Vice President for Development and Public Relations. Ron, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. It's nice to be on.
And by Alice Leo, a nurse in surgical services at Porter and president of the Porter Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. Alice, thanks to you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Ron, I want to start with you because I'd like to get a sense of some of the financials, and then Alice will bring you back in as well. Porter's layoffs and contract issues have been presented as a necessity because of the financial problems the hospital is having. How would you characterize the finances of the medical center?
Well, I think you did a really nice job in your introduction. Porter Medical Center has lost $11 million since 2012 through our operations, and it is only because of the 340B drug program that you referenced in your opening that we've been able to sustain ourselves. These are dollars that we do not generate ourselves. These are dollars from Washington that actually come from the pharmaceutical industry, which has been trying for a number of years to eliminate that program, which is a safety net program for hospitals and folks, patients. So we are doing our best to sort of sustain the organization. Our year-to-date financial situation is that we are about $1 million off of our budgeted performance through January. And, you know, we have lost $7 million every year in our practices for the last several years. So, you know, we have to look at our expenses, as all hospitals do. And I'm glad, again, you put it into a larger context, because according to Modern Healthcare, roughly a third of rural hospitals in the United States ran a deficit last year. So, you know, we are not alone. This is not a Porter exclusive issue, but we feel, and our board of directors feels, that we need to take some steps to bring our expenses in line with our revenue in order to provide basic patient care and our mission, fulfill our mission in the community, which is what we're really here to do. And be good, you know, financial stewards of the organization. So these are hard, painful, difficult decisions we've had to make. They're not made lightly, and they're made with the interest of our organization and our patients in mind. So that's sort of where we are.
You know, on that question of the 340B drug pricing program, and this is the federal government sponsored program that allows critical access hospitals to buy these drugs at a reduced rate, which has been helping with your financial situation.
Right.
Dan in Lincoln emailed in to say, I don't fault Porter for wanting to wean itself off its reliance on the 340B program, and they're understandably concerned that this funding could be curtailed or eliminated in the future.
Right.
But it paints a very misleading picture to claim that the money was lost rather than that Porter, as a critical access hospital, receives some government support, as many similar hospitals do. And Dan says, my concern is that an exaggerated number may be used to justify extreme action that's actually detrimental to the long-term interests of the hospital and the community it serves.
Sure.
I mean, did say this is a situation that many hospitals find themselves in.
Right.
The actions that Porter has taken to strip the contracts of providers and put in place new ones, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, and to lay off some nurses and some other staffers, you know, are not things necessarily that we're hearing from some of the other community hospitals in Vermont.
Well, again, as I said, roughly a third of the hospitals throughout the country are looking at deficits, and I think every hospital has its own particular financial situation. You know, I think that the person who wrote the email, I just want to clarify, the losses that I'm talking about, the $11 million in losses, were through our operations. That's actual money that we you know, are trying to generate through patient care activity. The 340B money is non-operating revenue. Those are dollars that we add back to our financial statements after we account for what we do as an organization to provide care. So, you know, these dollars are basically sort of sopping up the losses and getting us to a point where we're able to sustain ourselves, and we have been sustaining ourselves. But when we look down the road at payment reform and healthcare reform and having to reinvest in another electronic medical record down the road, you know, we cannot just sustain ourselves. We actually have to have enough financial strength to continue to provide the outstanding care that our doctors and nurses provide every single day and give them the tools they need to do that. So, you know, that's how I would respond to that.
I want to bring Alice Leo back in here, but sure. Just before we do, Ron Hallman, just very briefly, and we'll go into more of the details as sure. We have this conversation, what is the plan to get Porter back on track in that case?
So we have a short-term one-year plan that involves a number of steps. The first is to integrate all of our overhead departments, which we've done. We used to have two dietary departments, one at the hospital, one at the nursing home. We used to have two housekeeping departments, one at the hospital, one at the nursing home. So we've integrated those into a single department. Not a single person lost their job during the integration, but we were able to gain some efficiencies. We've improved our supply chain by some group purchasing arrangements so that we're now buying supplies through a much larger purchasing arrangement and saving a lot of money there. We've also included on the revenue side, a brand new infusion center, which is providing necessary services here in our community to folks who otherwise would have to drive to Burlington or Rutland for infusion care, as well as some cardiology services. We had to make some adjustments to our staffing, which we're going to talk about and we've talked about, in order to address some structural problems, specifically in our practices, that we're losing $7 million a year. We've reduced overtime significantly, and we've adjusted our staffing in every single department throughout Porter Hospital and the nursing home in order to have a staffing model which is commensurate with national and regional benchmarks. So, you know, we're doing a lot of things. Obviously, when we have to eliminate 17 positions out of 780. It is newsworthy, and it does get a lot of attention, but there's a lot that's also happening behind the scenes in terms of improving revenue, improving the services we provide, and reducing overhead expense that doesn't quite get out there as much. But these are significant things that we're doing.
And we are going to talk about some of those things and those 17 positions that you mentioned. Some occurred a couple months ago, when I believe 8 people were laid off, and now there have been 9 that have just been laid off. Alice Leo is with us as well. She is with the Nurses Union, a nurse in surgical services, and she's president of the Porter Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. And I also want to invite listeners, if you are a Porter patient and you want to ask a question about patient care or how this might affect you, changes you might see or not see, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or if you're a Porter provider, we would love to hear your take. You can make a comment on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Alice Leo, 8 nurses were laid off recently, and there were several LPNs, licensed practical nurses, who have a slightly lower educational attainment than RNs. That's one of the distinctions between all those acronyms. And they were laid off last year. Sometimes financial considerations mean there have to be layoffs. So what's your main concern here in this?
So it always comes back to patient care. So that's our main concern. We believe that our community shouldn't have to drive to Burlington, for example, for their care, that they should be able to receive high-quality care in Addison County. So that's where our concern is. And having a registered nurse is really necessary for quality, safe care.
And losing eight means what? That patients won't get quality care in Addison County?
So our concern is in the doctor's offices where these eight nurses were laid off. It means that there's not a nurse in the office every day. It puts more work on the provider, for example. For example, if you call in, you have a question about your lab results, there's not a nurse there to answer that, then that goes to the provider. So that takes away time that the provider would have to spend with patient care.
Given what Ron Hallman told us about the financial situation that Porter is in and the need to make some changes in order to get stability, what would you think would have been a better choice?
Well, I think the focus was in the wrong place. Taking away hands-on, taking away nurses who do the hands-on care is probably not the best place, isn't the best place to be looking for cutbacks. We have no idea where else they looked. For example, they have hired more management people, for example. And so while they're laying off nurses, they're hiring more management, which makes no sense to us. You need the people to do the actual care. So I'm not a financial person. None of us were ever asked, those of us who work in the hospital or in the doctor's offices or in the nursing home, we were never asked, you know, or never said anything to us about this is what's going on, we're concerned about finances, you know, what can we do? No one ever asked us.
So, Ron Hallman, it sounds like there are a couple of concerns here, and one of them is communication, and that seems like a broad concern. We've heard from many Porter providers who also feel like the issues that Porter was having were not communicated effectively to them, and they were not brought into the process of how to actually make some of these efficiencies work that would preserve patient care. But to Alice Leo's question about that patient care issue, I know you've had to defend this move, so how do you defend it?
Sure. Well, let me start by saying there actually are going to be nurses available to talk with patients every single day in every practice. And I also want to say that we truly value and appreciate our nursing care and our nursing staff. They're, you know, essential members of the team. But it is a team. It is a team that is comprised of nurses and physicians and medical assistants and therapists. And I think we allowed our team to get a little too many of one type of provider and not enough of another. It just sort of organically over time sort of got to that point, and it the losses were unsustainable. And, you know, our clinical leaders in our practices did assess the team, you know, according to very standard, you know, benchmarks around the country, and have recalibrated, you know, each practice according to those benchmarks. And the other
are you talking about the changes that were made? We're putting in medical assistants in the place where there have been nurses. Is that what you're talking about staffing issues?
So it's not in place of. It is, you know, it is in addition to. Again, I think it's really important that we don't give the impression that we are, quote, replacing nurses with MAs. You know, it's, you know, the analogy is it's sort of as if you inherited a baseball team and you had nine pitchers, you know, and you realize, you know, you need four infielders, you need three outfielders, and you need a catcher. It doesn't mean you don't like your pitchers. It means that they're a member of the team, and you need to have basically all members of the team in their role doing the job to the top of their license, to the top of their role. The other thing I want to mention is that when we did the position eliminations, four managers lost their job, as well as some clinical folks. So I just want to be sure that it's not on the record that managers were not affected, that this was all about eliminating nurses. There were actually nine folks who lost their jobs that were not registered nurses. And, you know, and we had to do some restructuring of management as well. And we had to eliminate some managerial positions in order to get the right members of the management team and the right roles too. So, you know, this is hard for the nurses. It's hard for the LPNs, and it was hard for the managers. And frankly, it's hard for all of us to have to make these very difficult and challenging decisions, but it's about our patients and our mission and sustaining Porter for the future, and that's what we have to focus on. So that's what we have to do.
Alice Leo?
So it all comes back to patient care. Nurses are well-informed, well-educated. We're passionate about the well-being of our patients. When it comes to the offices and the laid-off nurses in the offices, those offices were never asked, how will this work for you? The feeling has been is that there were a certain number of people that needed to be, that the Porter wanted to lay off, and they just went by the numbers without actually talking to the people there, asking, how is this going to work? And again, it all comes back to patient care. And that's really it.
Yeah, and I agree with that. It is all about patient care, and I'm you know, Alice and I agree on that. We work for the same organization. We're colleagues. We both care deeply about our patients. We care deeply about our community. We have some really, really outstanding nurses. We have some really outstanding physicians, and they provide really good care every single day. But the issue is we're losing money, and if we don't have the financial resources to provide these outstanding nurses and doctors with the tools they need to provide care, then we're not doing our job, and we're not being good stewards of the organization. And as hard as it is, and believe me, it is dramatically difficult to have to tell someone their position has been eliminated. I've had to do it, and it is painful. But, you know, we have to remember that Porter Medical Center is here for the 38,000 people of Addison County. And those are the people that we have to get up every single morning thinking about, our patients, our community, the folks who depend on us to keep the doors open and to keep the lights on. And, you know, I hate it that we can't retain every position and that we can't hang on to every way we've always done things in the past, but you know, with healthcare reform and the changing environment that we're living in, we just cannot keep doing things the same way.
I want Alice Leo to jump in here because we've got a lot to get to, and Alice, I know you wanted to respond.
Yeah, so laying off nurses and other workers, pressuring the providers to see more patients in the same amount of time, is not in keeping with Porter's mission of patient-centered care. And again, it always comes back to patient-centered care. Laying off frontline health caregivers is not patient-centered care. I have no idea where else Porter looked where it could save money other than laying off frontline health caregivers.
Let me read a couple of comments that have come in. Sarah in Bridport says, the Porter midwives and physicians will be joining practices to create a single practice, Porter Women's Health. As part of this new arrangement, the midwives and physicians will be sharing call for labor and delivery. This means that a woman who's been seeing a physician throughout her pregnancy may have a midwife at her birth. Likewise, a woman who's been seeing a midwife may have a physician at her birth. And Sarah asks, why is Porter Medical Center diminishing women's ability to choose the type of practitioner who cares for her during labor and delivery? And looking also at the patient perspective, another listener wrote to say, I'm a Middlebury resident concerned about the changes taking place. While I understand the need to turn around Porter's financial situation, I'm worried that this will result in a loss of quality medical care in Addison County. I have heard that physicians currently employed by Porter practices are actively looking for employment elsewhere because of significant salary cuts in their new contracts and because of nursing shortages that make their work untenable. And coming right up here on Vermont Edition, we are going to talk with a doctor who's a Porter affiliate. I should say we have had a lot of trouble getting a Porter doctor to come on the program with us, many telling us they're afraid they might lose their job. So we'll talk about that. And if you would like to share your perspective, our number is 1-800-639-2211 or post a comment on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at the financial and cultural issues at Porter Hospital in Middlebury, Porter Medical Center. The 25-bed community hospital recently laid off some nursing staff and administrative staff, and we're hearing today from VP Ron Hallman and Nurses Union President Alice Leo about the changes and how they're being received. Are you a Porter patient or provider? Care to share your questions or concerns with us? You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800. 800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We did get a note from John who says his wife works for a porter practice, and he writes to tell us his concerns. He says, "My wife and I moved over 2,000 miles to Vermont for her job. She felt that working at a community hospital in Vermont would allow her to practice in a way that aligns with her values and principles, and it has. To work at Porter, she, like many others, compromised on her earning potential. Porter has now proposed, as a way to cut costs and boost revenue, that medical provider salaries be based on the income they bring to Porter, RVU, relative value units. These new contracts have clawback clauses. While on the surface this can make sense, it creates incentives for truncated and more costly patient visits. I worry that these and other changes ask medical care providers to compromise values and principles that drive quality patient care. Those who provide themselves on good care will seek employment elsewhere. The 990s, the tax forms, should reveal other, less damaging ways to cut costs." And Lewis Holmes, a doctor in a Porter practice, emailed in and said, "The providers of Porter Hospital looked forward to the arrival of the new administration last summer, hoping it would bring some needed and welcome changes to help us improve efficiency, quality, and patient care. This financial crisis is an opportunity for all of Porter, from CEO to technician to LNA to physician, to work together to identify strengths, weaknesses, and opportunities for improvement and change. We are not afraid of change. Medicine requires an ability to evolve in practice style, knowledge, and approaches to patient care. What has been challenging are decision-making processes that do not adequately recognize and access the human strengths of Porter Hospital and each community practice. These decisions have not always used a collaborative approach to build collective understanding and support for changes and have not always welcomed contrary recommendations and concerns." And Dr. Holmes says the medical staff looks forward to future collaborative efforts with the administration that will continue to improve patient care, teamwork, efficiency, and morale. And let's get another voice into the conversation, and then Ron Hallman, I know I'll give you a chance to respond. Dr. Jean Anderson Swayze is with us. She's an independent doctor and a partner at Middlebury Family Health. She's an affiliated member of the Porter Medical staff. Dr. Anderson Swayze, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So I should say here, we tried talking to a number of doctors who are Porter staff, who are not affiliated doctors, but who are on the Porter staff. And producer Rick Singeri and I must have talked to at least 10 or 11, none of whom were willing to come on the program, but you were. You say you're a little bit removed from this situation. So I would like to know, from your perspective working with the hospital and with providers, what you're observing and what your perspective is.
So you're right. I'm not employed by Porter. I'm a member of Middlebury Family Health, which is a small independent family practice. But I am an affiliated member of the medical staff. And it's a small town, and I know many of the doctors. And I've been in a unique position to kind of watch the changes that have occurred in the past 6 months. Like Dr. Holmes mentioned in his email, there all along, I think there's been a realization that Porter has some work to do in financial belt tightening. And that was a top priority of the search committee, who's trying to find a new CEO, to find someone who had a solid track record in that department. So initially with the new administration, there was a lot of optimism and faith that things could be turned in the right direction. However, in the past couple of months, I'd say this trust, which really is an essential component of leadership, has completely evaporated, and a curtain of fear has descended. It's really quite shocking. The recent waves of job cuts have seriously affected morale. They seem to have been done with little communication or forethought about how they would affect the healthcare team. And as a result, there are legitimate concerns about understaffing and safety. With no sense of partnership or collaboration, there have been a wave of providers who have either left or tendered their resignations in the past 6 months. I know of at least seven. And the more concerning thing is that there are numerous other providers who are thinking about leaving.
So what's your concern then? Do you think Porter can survive that?
Definitely not. I mean, if you start losing providers, or if the administration miscalculates how many providers are going to re-sign their contracts, which were terminated recently, then you're going to lose patients. If you lose patients, you lose referrals, you lose attributed lives, you lose the 340B money. And in a very little time, you've created a potentially disastrous situation. I mean, really, we need to look beyond Porter and its providers to solve this problem. The root of it, I think, lies in the fact that primary care is underfunded and underappreciated. And in this current healthcare world, the bigger you are, the more healthcare dollars you bring in, which is why you're seeing independent doctors folding. You know, all we have to do is look in Franklin County and see the pediatric practices that went out of business. And I think that's probably one reason why Porter is looking to affiliate with the UVM Medical Center. Would they be better reimbursed if they were paid at the same level as the UVM doctors? We need a new system that values primary care, where there's complete transparency and pay parity, not one that's throwing millions of dollars into creating an ever-growing healthcare bureaucracy. Those Porter primary care offices are being unfairly blamed for using $7.3 million a year, because they're the actual, they're the engine of the hospital. They're the ones that are bringing in the patients. So it's a very concerning situation. I've talked with a number of Porter providers who feel like they've had the rug pulled out from under their feet. The new contracts have been stripped of loan repayment programs, and they're based on unrealistic performance and productivity measures, which, in fact, are punitive. There was also initially a 50-mile non-compete clause, which apparently has since been pulled. But all this is very disturbing, and I think it speaks to this top-down approach that the administration has, which really isn't what our community is all about. Vermonters are about collaboration and trying to come together to solve problems rather than having decisions thrown at them.
That's Dr. Jean Anderson-Swayze, a partner at Middlebury Family Health and an affiliated member of the Porter Medical Staff. Dr. Anderson-Swayze, I really appreciate your perspective. Thank you for coming on.
You're welcome.
We also got a note from a Porter employee who wants to remain anonymous, who says, I've only worked at Porter for a relatively short amount of time, and I've definitely noticed that there's a culture of fear that's become the new norm with this administration. I'd like to know what steps the administration plans on taking to remedy this situation so that people can speak out about legitimate concerns without fear of retribution. You know, Ron Hallman, there is a clause in the new contracts for doctors that says they can't do anything that might damage the reputation of the medical center, and they've told us that that's one reason why they're afraid to talk about what they see as concerns or problems in the current situation, and they say they worry for their jobs. So we just heard Dr. Anderson-Swayze talking about sort of a toxic culture. How do you respond to that?
I'm not aware of a single physician who's had any kind of retribution. I'm not aware of a single physician who's lost their job by expressing their opinion.
But it sounds like they don't feel like they can express their opinion.
Well, I guess that's a choice that everybody needs to make as to whether, and I mean, it, you know, anonymous emails and unsigned letters and comments about what people perceive may happen in the future. I guess we can all sort of evaluate on our own how we feel about that type of fear and that type of reality. All I can deal with is facts and actual actions and actual things that we're doing.
Well, so let's bring it right there, because let me just interrupt you to say, you know, let me bring it there because you're right. And that this is a problem that we've had in planning this show, is you want somebody who can say who they are and what their concerns are,
right,
and speak with their name. But
and I really appreciated Lewis Holmes signing his name to the letter, because actually I agreed with what a lot of what Lewis said, you know, that.
But to that question of then a culture of fear, which I think we can speak to, because what we're hearing is a fear, and you're saying that fear is, it may not be reasonable, but it sounds like there is a toxic atmosphere at Porter Medical Center.
I totally disagree. I think there is a lot of angst and anxiety throughout our practices, because the practices are the part of the organization that are being affected by these changes and being affected in a real significant way, and I totally acknowledge that. You know, we basically have a nursing home. We have a hospital, and we have a network of practices. The network of practices are losing $7 million every year, and they are having a detrimental impact on the ability of the hospital and of the nursing home to provide the care that we need to provide to the patients. And I guess, Jane, the only observation that I'll make is, you know, I hear the words patient care a lot, but then it's followed by a lot of stuff about employment contracts and salaries and you know, and positions and jobs. And, you know, I totally understand how it is really difficult for change to happen and to affect a person's livelihood and their pay and their position. I absolutely understand that. I've been impacted by that in my own life. But, you know, I'm talking about focusing on the 38,000 people who depend on us for health care every day. You know, it makes me very sad to think that there are individual colleagues whose jobs are being eliminated or whose salaries are being scrutinized by introducing new productivity standards, quality measures, and patient satisfaction components in their contracts that have never been there before. You know, I understand that that makes things feel unfamiliar and uncomfortable, but I have to say, you know, that's, to me, not what we are here to do. The people who I walk up and down the hall and see at the hospital, the folks who I walk up and down the hall and see at the nursing home, and frankly, a lot of people in the practices, don't give me the impression of toxic. You know, I've been going to department meetings, talking about change, going to various parts of the hospital and the nursing home, and I've been here for 26 years, and I think I would understand if there was a toxic nature of this organization. And there's no toxic nature. There are some very strongly opinionated folks who have, who are suffering a sense of loss and also a sense that, you know, things are changing very rapidly. And
I'm going to stop you there because I want to make sure that we get one more thought in here from
sure.
Alice Leo before we end. Alice, you're listening to all this. What's your perspective?
So there's absolutely a big fear going throughout Porter Medical Center, despite what Ron says. I'm talking not just about the hospital, but the doctor's offices and the nursing home. There is a lot of fear out there, and I'm talking not only about nurses, I'm talking about housekeepers, kitchen workers, maintenance people, all the way up to providers. I have spoken to providers also who have also spoken of this fear of speaking out because of retaliation. So, you talk about it takes a village to raise a child. At Porter, it's always been it takes a village to take care of a patient. We've always worked together. In the past several months, what makes Porter special, that feeling that we're working together to take care of our patients, that feeling is gone. It's replaced by fear.
That's Alice Leo, a nurse in surgical services at Porter Hospital and president of the Porter Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've also been talking with Ron Hallman, Porter Medical Center Vice President for Development and Public Relations. Ron, I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, before we leave this topic completely, I want to put Porter's financial situation in perspective in the rest of the state, and we are joined now briefly by Mike Del Treco with the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Mike, thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me today. I really appreciate it.
So you've been listening to this conversation. Is this now, you know, leaving aside some of the specifics of internal negotiations at Porter, is the financial situation that Porter Medical Center finds itself in unique?
I think what we're seeing here is the result of potentially a broken system. I think specifically when we look at our reform efforts in the state of Vermont, we must take into account the fragile nature of our small community hospitals. When I define community hospitals, we have eight community, really small hospitals that are designated by Medicare as critical access hospitals. So when in this payment reform conversation, all hospitals understand the need to focus on, you know, reducing costs. But under the new payment models, these organizations have to be recognized in a different way. I think one of the callers really talked about primary care, the investment in primary care. That's one very specific area that needs to be focused on, developed. From a much broader picture, I would say that all of our Vermont hospitals really are looking at, you know, lowering the cost of care. In this, you know, situation that you have on the phone or in the show is very complicated and complex, but it's part of the conversations. We certainly want to make sure that everyone has access to high quality care that they can afford, and furthermore, it's about choice. We want to make sure everybody has a hospital and doctor of their choice.
But do you see the hospital landscape for Vermont changing such that we may not have the same number of full hospitals in the state in the coming years?
Really difficult to project and look down the road that far. That may be part of the conversation. I don't see us at that tipping point today. I think the challenges for our small organizations, you start to look at some of the regulatory process that the state of Vermont has, and when you look at sort of the cost component for small community hospitals, the regulatory budget process, which is a 3% cap on net revenues, creates additional pressure on controlling costs. The reason is that the smaller the base that you apply an inflation amount to, the fewer dollars that are available for things that you were just talking about, reform initiatives, updating equipment, and paying employee salaries. So if you sort of overlay that with the next level, the economies of scale on our rural hospitals are often, they have greater challenges. Their fixed costs to operate are higher. And when you think for a moment that the cost of highly trained personnel and specialized equipment is often equal or greater than, those costs are often equal or greater than the cost of larger organizations with better economies of scale, it gets really, complicated. For example, an MRI at Porter is probably going to cost the same amount as an MRI at Rutland Regional or Southwestern Vermont or University of Vermont Medical Center. In those organizations, it may be less expensive because of their economies of scale.
Mike Del Treco is Vice President of Finance and the Interim Co-Executive Officer of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Mike, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Have a nice day.
You too. Coming up, we check in on diversity initiatives at the College of St. Joseph in Rutland. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The College of St. Joseph in Rutland has an undergraduate population of just 250 students, but it bills itself as the most diverse college in the state. Nearly 40% of the student body is non-white, and St. Joe's also prides itself on the STEPS program, a full-time residential program for Vermont youth transitioning out of foster care. There are currently 10 students at the college who are in that program. Paula McGee is the school's director of diversity and inclusion and the director of the STEPS program, and she joins us now to talk a little bit more about how the school thinks about culture, cohesion, and diversity. Paula, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
Now, in a state like Vermont, that kind of diversity, racial diversity and socioeconomic diversity, is intentional. Why is that a part of what the College of St. Joseph wants to be?
It's part of our core values, the values that were established as part of the Sisters of St. Joseph's efforts when they began the college in 1956. We have a respect for all individuals. We want to include all individuals in our mission toward hospitality. And this is part of what I believe is why our diversity is so important to us.
You haven't been at the school for too long. You were brought in, I think, last spring to work on this?
I was.
And you're helping change the idea or the statement about what diversity is and what it means at St. Joseph. What does it mean?
Well, we pride ourselves on having a broad diversity, and we're moving from diversity toward inclusion. And the difference is, a lot of times diversity is seen as race and ethnicity. We want to show that inclusion allows access on the part of multiple groups to have access basically to higher education, success in life, and possibly becoming a part of the Vermont community.
So what kind of challenges does that present for your students, many of whom, as you've just mentioned, don't feel like or haven't seen access to a college education in the past?
Well, it means taking pride in what they are doing. One student mentioned to me that from Boston that on his street, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, no one had gone to college. Now, almost everyone goes to college as part of our initiative with the BASE, what we call the BASE program. It is an academic and athletic program in Boston, as well as the Boston Public Schools. So that is one thing. But the other thing is having access to different cultures, different socioeconomic groups, top-notch scholars. That gives students an opportunity to see another world that they wouldn't have come in contact with before.
So who are the students at the College of St. Joseph?
Oh, we have a great population. We have students, a large population of Cape Verdean students. Many of them are from Rhode Island. We have African-American students, Dominican Republic, Haitian. We have students from Vermont, all across Vermont, Vermont commuters. We have students of multiple backgrounds, as well as socioeconomic backgrounds, which include the STEP students, as you mentioned, who have come from a very different home setting than many of our other students.
One of the things that students have to do as part of a scholarship program is to do community service
right.
in the Rutland community. What do they do, and how do Rutland community members respond to them?
This has been a great part of our diversity and inclusion initiative. We have logged 10,000 hours of community service through our provider program. And that is part of this. That's one of the scholarships that have allowed that has allowed access for some of these students. They work at the Boys and Girls Club, a senior living center, the Dream Program, which is in through New York and Massachusetts, I believe. They also work with the food bank and in several other areas. Marble Valley grows. They do compost at the elementary school. So various things, various ways that they're needed here in the Rutland area.
And those 10,000 hours that they've logged of community service, that's just in a couple of years, right?
And that's in 3 years.
So that's a lot. So they're doing work in the community, but you've told me that in some cases you talk to students about places that they might feel concerns about being in Rutland or be perceived differently, often because of their skin color. So it sounds like there's good support, but not 100% support for students.
Well, not 100%. And we know that change is different. People who don't look like us are sometimes a little intimidating, or we're uncertain about those who don't look like us. We don't have many incidents. There have been some incidents based upon racial ethnic background, but we are in conversation and working with the Rutland Police Department. Chief Kilcullen and Commissioner Larry Jensen are both working with the College of St. Joseph to help make sure that our students, those of African-American and Latino descent, don't aren't confused with other elements of the community that may have had criminal records or run-ins with the police.
You know, Paulo, when you have so many students who come from different backgrounds and different states, different countries, it could be hard to feel a sense of cohesion within the undergraduate student population. I imagine that's part of your job and your charge. So how do you do that?
Well, not just my job. It's the entire campus that is devoted to making all of our students feel at home. For example, on Wednesday, there are no classes. We call that community day. That's when students do their community service. They have club meetings. But one thing in particular that I like, there is a community lunch, and we eat family style. Faculty and staff go up and have lunch with students. There is a common library hour where faculty members are there to work with their students if they need to. So that's part of the community piece. But being small, we have the opportunity to know names. And that is extremely important, to have students also do what we call unintentional bumps, where they come in contact with those who are not necessarily from their particular background in ways that are not contrived, more or less, but that will get them access to other activities. Another thing that I think is great, we have started Latino Dance Night. We really enjoy that. We've learned the machata and the salsa, and we're learning quite a few cultural things. So these are some things that make students comfortable.
Paula McGee is Associate Vice President for Student Affairs and Director of Diversity and Inclusion and of the STEPS program at the College of St. Joseph in Rutland. Paula, it was a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you, Jane.
That does it for today. Tomorrow, Vermont Republicans and Democrats will get their chance to vote in the presidential primaries. But what happens after you cast your ballot? We'll talk with the heads of the state political parties about the complicated, unfamiliar process that ultimately determines how Vermont delegates cast their votes at the national conventions. That's tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.